This picture is, oh yes, there. Oh, here's the abbot giving a lecture to the monks there. He's sitting on this chair that I was telling you about that they gave to me. And you can see how he's sitting on it. And there the monks are in front of him listening to his lecture. Now, the lecture of a Zen abbot would be not like a lecture I'm attempting to give now. It would be made up entirely of anecdotes. It would be made up entirely of conversations between a Zen master and some monk who would ask him a question. A monk might come up to the Zen master and say, "What is Zen?" And the monk would give him some strange answer. "The cat is climbing the pole." And the monk would say, "I don't understand." And the master would reply, "Ask the pole." Then the monk would go back and meditate on that for a while and try to make some sense out of it. Of course, the answer would not, one monk might give one answer and another monk might give quite a different answer, and they might both be right. It's not the answer that counts. It's the state of mind you're in when you give the answer. And the Roshi is supposed to have enough intuition and sensitivity to detect how far the monks have progressed in their progress towards that Tori. So these Zens, there are a good many of these Zen stories. I have a book over there with 101 Zen stories. One of them is the story that Eshin told about the two monks walking along the street, and they found a pretty girl waiting at a muddy crossroads and afraid to cross over, and one of the monks picked her up and carried her over. And then after the monks had gone quite a bit further, the other monk who did not carry her said, "You know that we monks are not supposed to have anything to do with pretty girls." And the monk who carried her said, "What, are you still carrying that girl? I left her behind." Well, that still illustrates the fact that you live in the present, and something that's happened in the past doesn't necessarily bother you. Here they are at a meal, I think. They're sitting with their hands folded this way, as they do before they start to eat. They eat all, at least in temples I visited, they sit around the edge, facing toward the middle, each one having his bowl in front of him, and all he has for food is a bowl of rice. There's a man in the middle of the hollow square with a big bowl of rice. And if you want any more rice, you put your hands this way, and he comes and gives it to you. You have rice, and you have tea, and you have fermented bean soup. Mitso, is that right?
Mitso,
fermented bean soup. It's not bad at all. And pickles. The pickles are there to give you the right vitamins, and the rice and barley and fermented bean soup, that's about all they get.
Of course, how can we tell them the pickles aren't our idea of pickles?
Now, sometimes they pickle whole turnips and radishes.
And they're pickled in salt.
Yes,
daikon.
Daikon, yes. Uh-huh. A daikon is a great big pickle. Mm-hmm. But they're good. At the first temple I visited, of course, I was a guest, and I wasn't given the same food as the other monks. As the monks. We were given fried seaweed and other delicacies of that kind, tempura and so on. This picture, they're going out to beg. They do that at periodic intervals, not as often as they used to. They hold out their bowls as they go along the street. They never say thanks because they think that by giving people a chance to give them a gift, they're giving that person a chance to make a self-sacrifice, and a self-sacrifice is a good thing for them, so they're really doing them a favor to let them give them something. So they receive it with a bow and go on, and finally they collect enough food. It used to be that these monasteries, they're not monasteries in the Catholic sense of that word, because they don't take vows for life. Poverty, chastity, and obedience is the Catholic monk, but the Zen monk doesn't make promises of that kind. He can go back and leave his, if he has a teaching job, he might go into a monastery for 2 or 3 years until he attains peace of mind and restful and calm and serene spirit, which is all he's looking for anyhow, whether it's Satori or not. He attains a calm and peaceful spirit. Then he goes back to his teaching, renewed and rested and ready for anything. And that might be true of a businessman. Eshi never mentioned the fact that there are nuns as well as monks. There are meditation halls for women, and there are temples for nuns, and in some temples there are both nuns and monks. It's very hard to tell the monks from the nuns, because the nuns have their heads shaved absolutely clean. And when you see a nun walking along the street, you don't know whether it's a man or a woman, because you can't tell by the hair or the dress. The head is absolutely smooth.
When you see a whole room full of people
from
the back, it looks like so many horses.
Yes, you can't see much but the bald head. Here they are working in the garden, I guess.
They're sweeping. Huh?
Sweeping, cleaning, yes. Mm-hmm. And here they're working in the garden. You know, Paul says in Thessalonians, he that doth not work, neither shall he eat. And there's the same saying of that kind in the Zen monastery. It's written on a board which hangs up. And they have various boards in the monasteries. A full-sized monastery, like the first one I visited way back in 1936, before the war, Eheiji, the head monastery of the Soto branch of the Zen sect, had a number of boards hanging out in front. It had 9 buildings altogether. And one of the principal buildings was the gatehouse, a huge building, beautiful gate, with 2 stories, and a number of the sutras or manuscripts were kept in the gatehouse. And they had another elaborate gate in another part of the wall, and they said that gate is for the emperor. And I said, does the emperor ever come here? He said, no, the emperor never has been here, but if he ever should come here, he'd come through that gate. So they kept that gate open for an emperor that never did come to the monastery and probably never would. For instance, one house at Eheiji, there was, of course, a meditation hall, the house where there was they printed their magazine and newspaper and so on. There was the bathhouse, and the guardian that presided over the bathhouse was a monk who became enlightened while he was taking a bath. So his image is there. And the abbot's headquarters. And there's one house that's entirely devoted to teaching the monks to chant the sutras. The sutras are pieces of Buddhist literature. I think they're about 10,000 altogether. And they chant these sutras. It sounds very much like the Gregorian chant that you hear in a Catholic monastery. They're very much the same rise and fall of the voice. When I went with my companion. My companion was the professor of religion at Tokyo University, and he was also interested in visiting these monasteries because he never had done it before. He wanted to find out more about Zen himself. Well, we went to this place where they marched around, about 300 of them altogether. They marched around in single file, around and around, chanting these sutras. They do that at funerals and weddings. Or if anybody wants a favor from the Buddha, or wants to accumulate some merit, he'll put some money in the box in front of the altar, and maybe the priest or whatever he is will chant a sutra in his behalf. Theoretically, Zen is like Quakerism. Theoretically, Zen has dispensed with all symbols and all fixed performances. there's a kakamona, a picture in some of the temples of a Zen master burning a sutra, showing that he doesn't think it's any good. There's another picture of a Zen master burning an image of the Buddha. And yet, in spite of the fact that they think that these images and sutras are only for persons who are unenlightened or who aren't even trying to get enlightened, only for people on the lower rungs of the ladder, you have to have some, you have to have milk for babes, St. Paul says, as well as good meat for the more adult. So the Zens try to have something for everybody. So they chant the sutras, and in every temple there is an image of the Buddha, although they look down on it as pure nonsense that you have to get beyond and above and beyond and away from. Well, I started to talk about this. All of a sudden, right in front of us, they formed two parallel lines. And here we were standing at one end, and here was the Buddha image at the other end. And I asked Dr. Kishimoto, he afterwards lectured at Pendle Hill, what do they want? And he said, they want you to go up this line, that is between these two parallel lines, light an incense stick, stick it in the ashes in front of the Buddha, and then come back. Are you willing to do that? And I said, yes, I'm quite willing. And I did. I marched up, lighted my incense stick, stuck it in the bowl of ashes, which is in the Buddhist altarpiece, contains an incense burner right in the middle, and then I marched back. I had to do that once in a Shinto temple. When I went to Japan in 1936, that was 12 or 14 years before my second visit, and that was before the war, I went to a hotel in Kyoto to have a haircut. And during my haircut, the barber said, would you like to visit a Shinto ceremony? He could speak perfect English, as of course everybody had to at that hotel. I said, yes, I would like to very much to visit a Shinto ceremony. So he told me where it would be and when it would be. And the next day, I went to this building, very beautiful Shinto shrine, holding about 100 people. They were all there, seated. And I took a chair at the back, I guess it was a cushion, Dabaton. And there was a platform in front. And here comes, in a beautiful white robe, with a high hat, comes the barber. And it turns out the barber was the chief Shinto priest, much to my surprise. And he saw me, and he beckoned to me, and come on. And I rather reluctantly walked up to front. He gave me a chair on the platform. And everybody was looking at me, and I didn't know what to do. I sat there, rather feeling rather sheepish. Well, people would come up there to do various things. Put things on the altar. You might put some flowers or fruit or perhaps a green branch on the altar or kind of a table or whatever you call it. And then he asked me if I would put something on the altar, and I was willing, so I put I think it was a pine branch. I'm quite ecumenical when it comes to Oriental religions. I don't see anything in them that's completely inconsistent with Christianity, although I don't claim to be very much of a Christian, though I am one. Well, it was everybody that came up to that platform would first bow to me, sitting there on a chair at one side. They'd bow to me, and then they'd put something on the altar. So it was quite a sensation to have people bow to you.